Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to Pam Genoff, author of the new novel, The Lost Girls of Paris. I'm Bob Custrow. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Our guest today is best-selling novelist Pam Genoff, a writer whose work frequently appears in the New York Times bestseller list. Her latest novel, The Lost Girls of Paris, is based upon the real-life women of the British Special Operations Executive Service, who served as secret agents in occupied France during World War II. Told from the perspective of the woman who ran the spy ring, an agent who risked everything in service of her country, and a widower working to uncover the fate of them all, Genoff's story is a remarkable story of heroism, betrayal, and friendship. Pam Genoff is the author of several books of historical fiction, including the New York Times bestsellers The Orphan's Tale and The Commandant's Girl. She previously served in the State Department and as the special assistant to the Secretary of the Army at the Pentagon. Pam Genoff received her law degree from the University of Pennsylvania, her master's degree in history from Cambridge University, and her bachelor's degree in international affairs from George Washington University. Pam Genoff, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Pam, I put a little emphasis there on those three degrees because I find it so interesting as someone who has three degrees in political science that you have this incredible academic pedigree in, let's just say, public policy and law. It appears you veered off course a bit from the days of your studying law and politics to become a best-selling novelist. How'd that happen?
Well, I view it more, someone's described life as a series of course corrections. So, you know, I've had a variety of trajectories that have led me to where I am today. Although, in addition to writing novels, I still teach law school at Rutgers. So right. I am still in the sort of public policy, I guess you would call it, side of things. So I had always wanted to be a writer as a child, but all through those years I lived abroad and I was in school. I never quite got started. And for me, the epiphany was actually 9/11. I had graduated from Penn Law and started practicing on September 4th, 2001. And 1 week later, when 9/11 happened, I had this real life epiphany of, oh my goodness, while being a lawyer is great, I've never realized my novelist dream, and so I went ahead and got started.
So when you were a kid, this is a question I oftentimes enjoy the answer to when it comes to novelists. They talk about how they consumed every book they could get their hands on. Were you necessarily the kid who read everything you could get your hands on as far as the great novelists of the age are concerned, or were you the more the policy wonk kid?
I was the novel kid. So it's funny, my mom just went to my 50th anniversary of my elementary school reunion. Not that I've been out 50, but they had a reunion for the school and she saw the principal. And the first thing he said when he heard the last name was, oh yeah, Pam, always reading. So it was kind of my hallmark. And actually one of my three kids is exactly like that, you know, reading in the bathroom and reading at the table. And one particular joy about, one anecdotal joy is that as a kid, I was a huge Judy Blume fan, and to the point where my fifth grade yearbook said the next Judy Blume. And lo and behold, last summer in Key West, I had the opportunity to meet her and become friends with her. And so she's one of my great childhood mentors.
Well, I so much enjoyed reading The Lost Girls of Paris, and people oftentimes ask me, how do you find your books? And the answer is, in a bookstore, and I just picked it up, and it looked interesting. I had no idea that it was based on the series of real events that I'd like you to explain in a moment. But the one thing that grabbed me was getting into it. I mean, there are some novels I read, and I'll read the review before I read the novel, and it may take me 50 pages before it gets really interesting. When you read The Lost Girls of Paris, you're not more than a page or two into it, and it's like, I got to hang in there and see what's going on here. This is really interesting. And one of your reviewers for The Orphan's Tale, which is, of course, the previous novel you wrote, again, somewhat historical fiction, said something like, you have riveting first chapters. Is that purposeful? Do you think of yourself when you sit down to write as I better figure out a way to grab these folks right away, or is that just your style of narrative writing?
Well, thank you. So I will say, first of all, that I consider the book to be inspired by real events as opposed to based on, because I worry as a novelist that I don't want to stake too large a claim around people's actual stories. But in terms of the starting point, as a novelist, your goal is always to start as far into the action as possible. So you're looking for that inciting moment and the bridging conflict that's going to bring the reader along with you from page one.
Yeah, well, with Grace finding that suitcase in the train station, you can't put that book down until you figure out what's going on. And, of course, that's over 300 pages later.
Well, you know, also I want to say that, you know, I have three narrators in this book. So
right.
I want to hook you with each of them. So it's not one of those books where you're flipping only to a certain character.
Exactly. That's the beauty of the book, I think, is you get these three different perspectives and you're flipping back and forth. Let's talk for a moment about the real life situation here. You obviously ran across the work of Sarah Helm, I believe her name is, who wrote about Vera Atkins, the real spy here. Tell us that story and then how that influenced your book.
Well, I should say I read dozens of accounts of these women in writing the book. And the true incredible story that inspired me is of the women who served in the Special Operations Executive. It was an agency created by Winston Churchill in the darkest days of World War II, and he wanted these agents to drop behind enemy lines and, in his words, set Europe ablaze, engage in sabotage and subversion, so that when the Allied troops came across the channel, the Germans would be slowed down. Now, the first agents in real life were men, but men were too readily detected, say, on the streets of occupied France, where the local men were off conscripted or imprisoned. And so there was this very radical idea of sending the women, and that's where my book picks it up. It looks at how they recruited and trained these women and how they deployed them into occupied Europe.
How many of these women were there, all told?
Well, of course, there were lots of women working in lots of different capacities, but my best estimate for SOE, the specific agency, is about 40 women, and about 12 of those never came home.
And those are the 12 that are really the focus of your book, would you say?
Well, my 12 are fictitious. But I took a rough estimate of the number in real life that never came home. And yes, their story and kind of not what happened to them, because we know they died, but how and why they were captured is really the heart of the book.
What need were the Brits trying to satisfy here? The invasion was coming. You've commented on what they were supposed to do behind these enemy lines, but they were both saboteurs and they were spies in the sense of sending information back to Britain. Is that correct?
So I would not say they were as much spies. There were other more established agencies that did the espionage work, the intelligence gathering. And so these agents were engaged in sabotage, which is blowing things up and, you know, breaking German things, and subversion, which is being liaisons to the local partisans, to the local French resistance. That was the two primary objectives. So really anything they were transmitting back and forth more had to do with those operations. They weren't sort of recruiting local assets and engaging in true espionage.
Yeah, well, you have some interesting examples of blowing things up in this book. There's no doubt that's what they were sent over there to do. Were these women the women you would expect to be saboteurs? Where did these women come from? I don't really care whether you want to address this from the standpoint of your novel or real life, except for the fact that I do not want to give away the plot of your book, or at least the way this all works out. We're going to save that for the listener and the reader.
Of course. So in both real life and in my book, once the idea was floated to send women, a huge question was, where would they get the women? Because with men, they had traditional pipelines of the military and of the colleges, which women just really weren't there at that time. So women came from all over Britain. They might have volunteered if they heard of the work, or someone might have spied them and said, hey, you might be suitable. They were screened at Baker Street in London in an unmarked building there. And then if deemed suitable, they were sent off to the training school.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Pam Jenoff, author of the new novel, The Lost Girls of Paris. I mentioned the research on the book. Where'd you have to go to do this research? Did you have to travel much? You mentioned that you read a number of different books or things that informed you, but did you have to travel places to talk to folks?
Well, let me say this. I love travel, and I know authors who go to Italy, say, four times for a book, which sounds lovely, but is not always possible and, frankly, not always necessary in this internet age. So, you know, I'm lucky to teach at a university with a massive library system, and they help me get whatever odd books I need. And beyond that, you know, beyond books, there are journals and memoirs and periodicals and maps and photographs and on and on and on, so that, you know, there might be a specific need to go somewhere, but much of it can be done remotely. And whereas some books I've written, there's been a lack of material, this was very much the opposite. Much has been written in a nonfiction sense about SOE and the girls, such that the challenge was really knowing when to stop and to begin writing.
And I gather from some of the things I've read about you that back in the day when you had your position at the Pentagon, you did travel to events around the globe, including Slovakia, the Philippines, Bestonia, commemorating the 50th anniversary of World War II. I suspect that that informs your work to some extent, especially when it comes to your last new novels, both of which touch upon the Holocaust and are set in World War II.
So my background is that I spent about 5 years living in Europe, and roughly 2.5 of those were for the State Department in Poland working on the Holocaust. So I have spent a ton of time on the ground over there. And when I was at the Pentagon, it was the 50th anniversary of World War II, and I was privileged enough to go around the world with my boss to the commemorations. And so I really do have a very firsthand knowledge of the places and the people I'm writing about. And my books come from a love of the era and a want to kind of do it justice.
There's a thread throughout your book of trusting people above you, people who employ you. And there's a line in your book at one point, "I had no choice. I was acting on orders." And it's a justification this British official is trying to give after, again, I'm trying to be careful here not to give away the plot, but there is a betrayal. And that sounds a lot like what a Nazi would say, what they did, in fact, say at Nuremberg. "I had no choice. I was following orders." Did you do that purposely? Show us the comparison, if you will, between the two regimes?
It's ironic. I don't set out to make an overt comparison when I'm writing or develop a theme so sort of in a heavy-handed way. It's oftentimes in conversation after the book comes out, conversation with people such as yourself, that I begin to see those parallels. But what was very conscious to me as I was writing it is that, you know, the agents were betrayed. And without giving too much away, there were many theories of how they were betrayed. But a very prevalent theory in real life is that they were betrayed by people above them. You know, and so it really does become a question of the trust that we place in our government and whether such trust is warranted. And I think that's a theme not only relevant during the war, but also today.
So I'm fascinated with one of your protagonists, I guess I could call her Grace, who really starts off the book. And there's a somewhat of a love interest in the life of Grace, but it doesn't work out like I would have liked it to work out. And I guess I'm curious as to how a novelist goes about that, and more importantly, why a novelist goes about that in that fashion. It's the sign of a very strong woman who knows what's best for her, I suppose, and help us understand that. Again, we're talking somewhat cryptically here, but you can decide how much of this story you want to tell.
Well, let me give a few lines of context before I answer. So sure. Grace is what the closest we get to our modern day character in the story of the three women. She's the most present, but by present we mean 1946, right? While the others were during the war. I might have put her in, you know, 2019 or something like that. I've considered it. But in fact, she's in 1946, which makes her role tricky because you can't just solve a mystery in 1946 by hopping on the internet or, you know, flying over to London. So Grace is what I call not quite a war widow. She lost her husband during World War II, but she didn't lose him to combat. She lost him in a pre-deployment accident. And Grace is living alone in Manhattan, and she's got grief and she's got guilt when she stumbles across that suitcase in the station with the girls' pictures. Now, what complicates Grace's grief and guilt is the fact that she's just had a one-night stand, which is, you know, really radical in 1946, right, with her deceased husband's best friend. Mm-hmm. And so that is the romantic relationship that's kind of playing out or not playing out throughout the rest of the book. And, you know, ultimately for Grace, it's a story about finding her way. So she's not looking to find her way into the arms of another man. She learns that the way forward is, you know, by being true to herself. So that's part of what's going on. And you've sort of alluded to maybe I haven't given the readers what they want with that relationship. But let me say this. I don't know if you remember Little Women, Louisa May Alcott.
Sure.
There's this relationship between Joe and Laurie. And that book was written as an installment in, a newspaper or a magazine. And so Louisa May Alcott was hearing back from readers about what they wanted to happen in that book. And she was just darned if she was going to let those two wind up together the way the readers wanted. So yeah. I always think of that.
That's a great way to look at it. Well, I know our readers will enjoy the book and this particular aspect of it. So Eleanor Trigg, the spy runner, tell us a little bit about how she differs from Vera Edgecombe.
Okay, so Eleanor is my character most closely related to a real-life person, although mm-hmm. she's still fictitious. And the real-life person is Vera Edgecombe. And some readers may have heard of Vera. She was the woman who was in charge of running the women's part of Special Operations Executive. Now, Vera was not a likely contender for this role. She was of East European Jewish descent. She wasn't British. And up to a point, she wasn't even naturalized. So she was very much so an outsider at the agency, but she was very good at what she did. She was also kind of an outsider with the girl she was overseeing because she couldn't really be part of them. It would cloud her judgment. And so she's a bit of an enigma. At points, it was suggested that she might have betrayed them, which seems unlikely. And then after the war, she went to find out what happened to her girls. So there are a lot of similarities between Vera and my character, Eleanor. But without ruining it for the readers, let me say the fate that befalls Eleanor in my book is fictitious and was not what happened to Vera.
Well, I must say that what's so interesting for me in reading a book like yours is the fact that I still have too many bad memories of those history classes where I had to memorize all these dates and all these events, and I never really felt like I got inside the people who were making history. And I'm sure historians would quibble with me on this one, but too often historians, that's not their job. They don't focus on that. Your book gets into that. But at the end of the book, immediately I ordered a copy of Sarah Helm's book on Vera Edgecombe because I wanted to know what was the real life side of this story. And I guess that's what is so interesting. If a listener out there reads your book and then wants to find out more about the actual history of this person and the events, is Sarah Helm's book the place to go?
There were many, but I really liked hers. I would start there. Yeah. I would absolutely start with that book. And my challenge is, you know, to give the history but not stop the story. So for me, it's a constant balance. I don't envy the historians.
So let's talk about Marie. I want you to tell us a little bit about Marie, who, man, I really fell in love with Marie and what she did. And as a matter of fact, she fell in love, which is another interesting subplot of your book. There are a number of them that makes this such a good read. Tell us a little bit about that.
So Marie is a young mother in Britain. She's a single mother who's had to send her child out of London due to the bombings. And she is recruited to join SOE. And after much agonizing, she decides to do it. And it's really a fascinating thing to think about a single mother leaving her young child to go off and serve an agency where your life expectancy, once you were in the field, was really just a few weeks. You know, it's quite a controversial and difficult question as to whether one would do that, you know, during the war. In fact, there were mothers with young children who served the agency. And so that was a bit that I drew from real life. Once over in the field, as you've alluded to, Marie does develop romantic feelings in a complicated situation. Also inspired by real events where at times men and women were working together in the field under dangerous circumstances and with long hours together and feelings developed.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marie's courage was not only leaving this little baby and taking off for France, dropped into France behind enemy lines and playing the role of saboteur, where at any point you could get captured and tortured. But then at some point in the book, she goes one step further in her courageous moments when she decides to stay behind.
Yeah, so it's interesting. You know, I love writing about these women. Through normal events, they, you know, have walked a certain path in history. But from the war, they find themselves thrown off that path and tested and challenged. And Marie's just a great example of that, because not only did she step up to train and be deployed, but once over there, you know, nobody's role was as clear as it had been in training. And she found herself called upon in all sorts of ways that she couldn't have imagined. And then she grew to a point where she took on challenges that perhaps even others could not have imagined.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Pam Jenoff, author of The Lost Girls of Paris. The novel is a powerful story based upon the real-life British women who served as spies and saboteurs during World War II. And tell us about how Eleanor's service comes to a rather abrupt conclusion.
Well, Eleanor, you know, when Grace finds that suitcase in Grand Central in 1946, it has the name Trigg on the outside, or Trigg, who was the spy master. And Grace is faced with the question of who was Eleanor and why is her suitcase in New York? So she begins to unravel this history. And I don't think I'm giving too much away, because this is right at the beginning of the book.
Right.
She discovers that the reason Eleanor's suitcase is sitting in Grand Central is because Eleanor has just been killed in an unfortunate car accident outside Grand Central. So she has to unravel the mystery without the benefit of Eleanor's information. And what we see through the three narratives is that after the war, Eleanor went asking questions about what had happened to her girls. And as she got too close to the truth, she was sort of shut out. So she had her own mystery to solve.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions at the tail end of your book in the discussion section was, war makes ordinary people do extraordinary things. Could you comment on what impact you think war has on the characters in your book? And is that part of the tale here, that Marie really was an average person up until the time she was sent to France?
Each of these women is just so tested and changed by what they experience, by some defining moment in their lives, whether it's Marie being deployed or Eleanor losing everything when the SOE missions begin to fail, or Grace even finding the suitcase and being forced to confront her own truth. So it's fascinating to take these women and see how they develop in those circumstances.
At the tail end of your book, you have an intro. The publisher put an intro to The Orphan's Tale, which is actually the book that precedes The Lost Girls of Paris. And that, too, is set in World War II. Holocaust is part of the theme of that book. Are you on a run here? What's the next book going to look like? Are you still going to be in World War II?
Well, The Lost Girls of Paris is my 10th book, and while some of them were modern, most are historical, most of those are in the first half of the 20th century, and most of those are World War II. So I'd say my nucleus is World War II. I've written on the home front, I've written World War I, there's a lot of different ways to explore the material. But my next book is also World War II, and I'm working on it now. It's inspired by a true story of a young girl who actually had to survive World War II in the sewer.
You know, I'm curious about your distinction that you raised early in our conversation about the difference between historical fiction and a novel that happens to be based on or stems from an original set of events. I never really thought about that before, to be honest about it. And is that a distinction that you've made, or is that a distinction that publishers and authors are well aware of and are careful when they decide to promote their books as either historical fiction or something other than?
No, I actually, to clarify, I don't think there's a distinction. I think it's all historical fiction, but it stems from my very personal belief that we as writers of historical fiction must take care to say what we've done that is real and what we have fictionalized. And I think that historical fiction writers sometimes get in trouble by staking too large of a claim around what is true in their books. Mm-hmm. So for me, I say it is all fiction. I say I'm inspired by a real event, but in part because I actually believe that real life often makes for terrible plot, but it makes for wonderful setting. So if I can take the actualness of it and put it into the world that I'm building, that works better for me. But that means that I always want to be really careful and not claim too much is true, because I don't want to co-opt people's real life stories in a way that they might feel is disingenuous.
And when you say that authors get into trouble, I'm just curious, and you may not know the answer to this, but does that mean trouble with readers who come back and say, hey, wait a minute, that's not the way it happened? Or is this like legal trouble that publishers have to be careful of because somebody's actually going to step in and sue, if I could use that horrible word?
I can't speak to any sort of legal trouble, but yeah. There are times when writers have said this story was true, and reviewers or historians or readers or experts have come back and said, these are the reasons it couldn't possibly have been true. And then it sort of destroys the trust, I feel like. Whereas if I say I was inspired because I read this, but the story I'm writing is fiction, I'm just more comfortable in that space.
Well, it's a great book. And I guess I'll ask a concluding question here. As you wrote this book, which is about frayed relationships and thrilling moments of intrigue, mystery, friendship, tragedy, all set against the backdrop of World War II. What did you most enjoy about researching and writing the book?
I really enjoyed reading about these women. You know, I've been working with World War II for 20 years, and if there's a story that makes my breath catch and I just say, oh my goodness, when I read it for the first time, then I feel like it'll have that effect on readers as well. So I particularly enjoyed the chance to bring to light these heroic stories of the women.
Well, Pam Genoff, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book is The Lost Girls of Paris. And just in case you've read that one, then go back and read The Orphan's Tale and take a look at the other long list of books that Pam Genoff has authored. Thank you for being with us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me.
Join us next week as we talk to Daniel Mason about his book, The Winter Soldier. And under the category of what have we been reading lately, I recommend A Bright Future, and hope to interview one of its authors, Joshua Goldstein or Stefan Quist, for an upcoming Reader's Corner show. The book's subtitle is How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. The authors show how France and Sweden have replaced fossil fuels with low-carbon energy sources. And we are not talking about alternative energy as we think of it, but new fourth-generation nuclear power that does not require off-site processing of nuclear waste, as the old breeder reactors did. Alternative energy simply cannot produce enough energy to combat the carbon still thrown into the air by countries like China. I've always been a bit skeptical of nuclear energy, but his book convinced me that we must take advantage of new developments in nuclear energy that will result in cutting fossil fuel by mid-century. We often look for beach reads, and I just finished one that will keep you reading well into the night, if not necessarily on the beach. Warning Light by David Ricciardi is a thriller that takes place in the Middle East, and given our thorny relationship with Iran, it's a timely tale of a CIA analyst who finds himself in the midst of international intrigue when he is targeted by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, and the hunt begins. This is a debut novel by Ricciardi, but he's just released his second book, Rogue Strike, which I intend to buy for any beaches I may visit. Finally, I just picked up The Overstory, about as far away from a beach read as you can get. The author is National Book Award winner Richard Powers. It's a novel about trees and a handful of people who learn how to see the natural world most of us miss in our daily routines, and then they are drawn up into its unfolding catastrophe. Clearly one of the best books of the year, if not the decade. If there's any bad news, it's the book's length, weighing in at 502 pages in its paperback version. The audio version takes 22 hours to listen. No mean task for sure. Not sure whether I'll get through it this year or next, but look for it on Reader's Corner later this year, I hope. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.